Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
Yeah. Okay. Nobody wants to sit on the other side.
Well, hello to stage right. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. We're going to do just the tiniest bit of tech because this, not Georgia Tech, but tech, you know, stage tech, because we don't normally do this, and thank you for joining us for this slight experiment. I am going to knock down the mix a little bit. Okay. Who's been to a live recording of a podcast before? Now you all have. It's started.
Not yet, man.
Well, by the people who hear this, they'll be hearing them at their first time. I don't know, the grammar of the future is hard for me. So welcome to a conversation between Nirmal and Ted. Dr. Nirmal Trivedi is an all-around badass here at the Center for Academic Enrichment and the architect of the GT1000 experience. And I believe ultimately it's your responsibility that we read Ted Chiang's short story, Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling, for the Common Reading Program, Project One, as it has been rechristened. Do you want to explain yourself a little bit, Nirmal, for that?
Like, justify that, yeah.
Yeah.
Project One is coming out of the first year reading program, and it's primarily oriented to giving all of the incoming class not only something to think about in terms of the text, but also something that they can do in terms of creating a profile, a portfolio that showcases some of the things that they want to do once they're here and what they want to aspire to in their next 3-4 years. And so it's a common project at the same time as it is a common reading program. And so it's in its inaugural year, and I think having Ted here as our inaugural speaker for Project One is really telling because of the subject of his work.
Excellent. And Ted, what would you like the students to know about you that they might not already know?
I don't know if there's anything. I don't know if there's anything that I want them to know about me. I prefer to remain a mystery, I guess. But
you've been thoroughly interpolated already, and no need to add any more to it.
I think so.
All right. And with that, the sound check is over. All right, Nirmal. So you've got the author in front of a microphone. What do you want to know?
Well, first of all, welcome, and thank you for being here at Tech.
Thanks for having me.
So many of the students have been reading your work, and especially Truth of Fact, Truth of Feeling, and been posting and thinking about the questions that it raises. And I'm wondering if we could back up a little bit first and just tell me how you got interested in this topic that you address in the story in the first place.
So specifically, you mean the question of life logging or memory?
Yeah, life logging.
Many years ago, I heard a presentation in which someone said that one day it would be possible that you know, computer technology would advance to the point and storage would become cheap enough that it would be possible to store a continuous video record of your entire life. And when I heard that, I thought, I don't know what that is going to do to us, but I know it'll do something. It seemed like it would be a profound change, but I wasn't sure exactly how. And that was many years ago. And in various ways, that idea, you know, just has sort of stuck with me over time. And in different contexts, I, you know, kept returning to the question of, you know, what would it mean if this was recorded, if I could consult if I could consult the video of this event after the fact. So, you know, it is something which has, I guess, yeah, been rattling around in my head for, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Because we're not that far from that reality, actually. Right now, it seems like we could basically life-log our lives if we wanted to.
Right now, today, it would be pretty expensive because they're, you know, generating that much video is gonna it's gonna fill up even the biggest hard disk, you know, pretty quickly. So we're not quite at the point where it's practical to store that much video. I think there was a an experiment recently. I think at MIT, where they recorded everything in a household. They're studying language acquisition in a baby, and so they were recording every word that was spoken in the household for, I think, the first year of that child's life. And that was a significant undertaking because that is a lot of a video. So, you know, that was something that required, you know, some real effort to do. So, you know, we are still a ways off from being able to do that for everybody, for, you know, not just 1 year, but for your entire life. We're still a little ways off from that. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's coming.
Did you pay attention to reality TV when you were sort of thinking how you'd approach the subject of life logging?
Not really. Actually, I'm not a fan of reality TV, and I think that the point of reality TV is different than sort of what the issue that I'm interested in, because I think the point of reality TV has more to do with being in the public eye, having an audience, having attention on you, and that is not the specific issue that I'm interested in. It's not so much whether you have an audience; it's just the fact that there is an actual record of what happened. And if you have access to it, what are the implications of that, even on a purely private level?
And did you do any life logging yourself, even on a small scale, to see what it felt like? Or, you know, is there a week or 2 weeks of your life that you've got?
No. I pretty much am. I'm pretty much as far away from a life logger as you can get, I think. In as much that I think that some of the early sort of steps toward life logging that people take now are people who are very active on social media, people who regularly update their Facebook status or check in on Foursquare or in some other ways are leaving a digital record of their daily activities. I don't do those things. Life logging is not something that I am personally inclined to do. And I guess, you know, that may be one of the reasons I find it interesting because it runs counter to my own inclinations.
Say more about that. Why is it so interesting if it's so counter to your inclinations?
Well, I guess because I think that it is coming. It is something that whether I choose to do it or not, I think that we as a society are moving in that direction. And so this practice, which I am not personally inclined towards, is something which I may have to deal with myself in the future. I may not have a choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. So just as a this is a very different example, but 15 or 20 years ago, I was talking with a friend, and he said, "Why would anyone carry a cell phone? Why do I want to have a phone on me all the time? That just sounds like a terrible idea." Of course, a few years later, he carried a cell phone around. I think that if you asked a lot of people, 15, 20 years ago, about the idea of, carrying a phone with you all the time, they would have been baffled by it. It's like, what is the point of that? That just sounds like a bad idea. But now pretty much everyone does have a cell phone. It's not, mm-hmm. It wasn't something that everyone was clamoring for, mm-hmm. but it's the reality now.
A lot of students read the story and they thought about it in terms of the pros and cons of technology, in that Ted Chiang is warning us about a world to come in which we don't have meaningful connection anymore because it's all mediated, transmitted through technology, in that contact and connection is now diminished and compromised. And I think a lot of students saw that as thought of the story as kind of a warning. And I'm wondering if what you make of that reading of the story and what your own perspective is in terms of the future, is what you're talking about in the story and technology mediating, being such a strong mediator, compromising our ability to connect with one another?
Well, I think that historically, people have always thought that technology was dehumanizing. I think that maybe the majority of technological inventions have probably been called dehumanizing by by somebody. Certainly. There was resistance to factory machines that would put people out of work. Machine looms instead of manual looms. The fact that and as another example of sort of the resistance to technology, I think when there's this famous anecdote of when the telephone was first invented, someone in Britain was they explained to him what this telephone was, and he said, "Well, maybe those Americans have some use for that, but we have messenger boys." And
it's too bad we don't have that anymore.
That's an interesting question. Is it too bad that we don't have messenger boys anymore? on the one hand, you know, I don't know that, I'm not sure if being a messenger boy was, you know, a particularly fulfilling job, a great job for someone. But, you know, there definitely was a personal touch to it.
Right.
Having someone deliver you a message by hand, you know, I'm sure there was something very nice about that. And we don't have that anymore. Are we better off or not? I don't think there is, you know, one, you know, simple answer to that. I think that most every technology has had its, you know, pluses and its minuses. Mm-hmm. And I guess I think that my story, actually, it's an attempt to make both cases, make the case for both sides. Mm-hmm. It is not intended as a polemic against life logging. Mm-hmm. It is, I hope, an illustration of the fact that life logging will have a lot of the same trade-offs that we have already accepted with technologies in the past. And the fact that we have accepted them in the past, you know, I think is something that we ought to remember when evaluating any new technology. Hmm. I'm not trying to
the be fact that a new technology always is almost always thought of in terms of a threat in turn until it becomes so familiar that and ingrained that it's become just a part of our everyday experience.
Well, I don't want to. I also don't want to be a sort of a cheerleader for new technology. I don't want to advocate, you know, sort of a an unexamined, you know, embrace of new technology. I think it's important for us to be aware of what we are losing when we adopt new technology. Because I think a lot of people who promote new technologies, you know, they position them as sort of unalloyed goods. You know, it's this is purely positive. There's no downside. This will just, you know, make your life easier. Why would you not want to use this? And you know, I don't believe that. I mean, I think that pretty much every technology does have a downside. I think that we will, you know, almost certainly wind up adopting new technologies because that has been the trend. Because new technologies do offer benefits, and you know, we get used to them, and those benefits are real. But you know, there are. There are drawbacks to them. Mm-hmm. There are things that there are costs associated with them, and I think it is worthwhile for us to be aware of them. Mm-hmm. You know, to understand what the trade-off we're making actually is.
So, switching gears to thinking a little bit about your own story, your own life. You told me that you wrote your first story when you were, did you say when you were 8 years old?
12.
12, okay.
Say, yeah.
Can we just say 8?
You can say 8 if you want.
but incorrect.
But I'm gonna stick with 12.
My memory, and we have no way to prove this, tells me that you said 12, but...
Normal, you should remember that life logging is about admitting you're wrong.
Yes.
Not
yes,
discovering
that's
that
the
you
story.
Were right.
Not that I was right, that you were wrong. So when you wrote that story, what compelled you and interested you so much in science fiction at such a young age?
Well, okay, so when I was 12, I was writing, you know, an adventure story about, you know, a war in space. That was, I think that's what you do when you're 12. You write. I think that's one of the appeals of science fiction when you're 12. There's something very exciting about the idea of, you know, battles in space. You know, vast warships, you know, firing on each other in the icy depths of space. You know, it's that is not what I write about now, but, you know, at the time, you know, that was what captured my imagination.
Did you think that you might end up doing it as a profession, as something that you might do for the rest of your life?
Actually, no, I never. Well, I mean, it was something that I hoped I would do for the rest of my life, but it wasn't something that I hoped would be my profession. In as much as, you know, being a day job, I was a big fan of Isaac Asimov, and for many years, Isaac Asimov worked as a chemistry professor, and he wrote science fiction on the side. And I sort of had this image that I would be, you know, I'd be a physics professor and write science fiction on the side. That was how I envisioned things when I was 12.
So you studied physics in college?
For a couple of years, yes, I did.
And you eventually ended up in computer science?
Yes.
Has that education, that background, informed what you write about?
I think it absolutely has. I think that physics definitely, I think, has played a role in a number of my stories, in providing, you know, either the inspiration or actually lying at the heart of some of my stories. Computer science, I think, probably less so, I think it definitely has had an effect, but it's harder for me to point to a story and say, here's the computer science in this story.
Mm-hmm. I should say that we have note cards sort of around you and underneath your chairs. And if you are interested in sort of a question, or if you have a question that you want to write, please do write them down. Or if you feel especially confident and brave, please come up and go ahead and ask the question into the mic up there.
So if anyone would like to go to the mic right now, please do. And if you want to wait and think about your question, you can write out it on a note card and bring it up. Hey, all right. There we go. Just now tap on that mic for the voodoo. There you go. Now go for it.
Hello. And it's weird hearing my own voice.
Tell us who you are and your major.
Hey, my name is Sam. I'm an industrial design student. I also love to do graphic design and illustration. So my question is about, well, first I have a comment, then a question. So I think when people try and envision the future as it relates to technology, they often envision the extremes. So think Skynet and then think the Jetsons. You know, like one type of technology is like ultimately like convenient and helpful with the Jetsons, and the other one is like destructive and like hell-bent on like everything against humanity. So I think the idea of the Remem, yeah, it's so realistic in that it has pros and cons, and it's like you said, it's kind of weighted on both sides. So what I was wondering is, I mean, have you looked at examples like for instance the movie Her? Have you watched that, and has that affected your work at all or inspired it? Like any precedents?
I have seen the movie Her, and Okay, I guess Her is, you know, I guess an interesting movie. I guess I will admit that I hated it. But I think it, you know, it is worth seeing. For those of you who haven't seen it and are interested in technology, it is worth seeing.
Please tell us why you hated it.
Well, I think that I think it wallows in two tropes that I really dislike. One is the manic pixie dream girl. I think we see a lot of movies in which a sort of morose, sort of mopey guy regains his love of life when an effervescent young woman enters it and reawakens in him, you know, his joy in living.
Sounds very plausible.
I think we've seen that. I think we've seen that really too many times in the movies, and I feel like the movie Her is definitely engaging in that. The other trope I think that it engages in is this identification of between women and robots. I think this is something that has a long tradition in science fiction, and I think it is a way of both sort of dehumanizing while simultaneously idealizing women. And I think, you know, again, we have seen it, you know, way too often. So I feel like those are two things that Her wallows in without any real self-awareness. However, I will acknowledge that a lot of people love the movie. They think they don't read the same things into it that I read into it. And so, a lot of people, a lot of smart people have, found smart things in that movie. So, I will certainly acknowledge that it is a science fiction movie which does not involve a lot of special effects. It does not involve a lot of explosions. It is about a relationship, and in today's given what most science fiction movies look like nowadays, that is noteworthy. So yes, there are good things about Her, but the bad things about the movie really bugged me. That said, did I, draw any inspiration from the movie? Not specifically. The movie does, I think the movie does deal with questions that I do find interesting. Because I am interested in questions about artificial intelligence and humans' relationships with artificial intelligence, I guess I'd been thinking about the issue for a long time before that movie came along, and so I can't say that it it brought anything new to the subject as far as I was concerned.
Anybody else want to come up to the mic or bring up a note card and I will ask your question for you? All right. Are the dehumanizing effects of technologies such as REMEM worth the positive effects it will have?
I don't think there's an easy answer to that. We have a lot of technology right now, and some people think that it has come at great cost, that it has dehumanized us already. Were the benefits that we got from them worth the dehumanizing downside? Different people are going to come to different conclusions on that. The fact that, this is a very different sort of example, but there are a lot of people who've been put out of work because of the internet. Like, travel agents, there are very few travel agents nowadays. In the past, there was an entire industry of people whose job was to, make your airline reservation for you. Nowadays, most people, they just go online and do it themselves. There are a lot of jobs which are like that, which now we do for ourselves. In some ways, that's convenient. In some ways, it is definitely not convenient because now everyone has to navigate airline reservation websites. Everyone needs a certain amount of expertise in that, which you didn't used to have. You could consult someone else, a travel agent, to do that. But we got rid of, travel agents, for the most part, disappeared for reasons of efficiency, because, it turns out it's cheaper to have people do it themselves. Are we better off not having, travel agents? I don't know. Some people, there are a lot of tasks that people who work in offices, everyone does their own typing. You used to have a secretary type stuff up for you. Now you type it up yourself. Everyone has to have some level of familiarity with word processing, most people who are typing up their own documents, they're probably not doing as good a job as someone when they had a secretary whose entire job was producing these documents. Ultimately it's cheaper. It's cheaper to have people do it themselves. Although some would argue that actually maybe it's actually costing a lot of productivity time by having people figure out how to format their own documents on their word processor.
Is there a version of truth of fact, truth of feeling that has more of this sort of economic analysis? Because you've mentioned jobs a couple times when you're talking about the the sort of swirling ideas around the story. But I don't feel like the story itself went after, here's where this will fall in economies, here's where this will fall in sort of the workings of capitalism. So is that something that didn't make it into the story? Is that something that's been happening recently?
No. Well, no, I guess that is those are just different examples. For the story, I was interested in other things. It's not about the economic impact, but I guess those just happen to be examples that came to mind just now. I guess those were things that, I've read some stuff about recently, and you know, maybe those are not the most relevant examples. But I mean, I think to some extent there is something to be said about the sort of impersonal nature of having so much technology around that you know we no longer interact with as many people as we used to. We interact with machines. You do it all. You know, you use an ATM instead of talking to a bank teller. A lot of times, you check out your own groceries instead of dealing with a human cashier. You know, that is a trend that has been going on and that will continue to go on. And you know, there is an element of dehumanization in that. If you know, someone 50 years ago were to look at you know the modern lifestyle, I think they would probably be horrified at how little interaction the average person has. That everyone is spending their time interacting with machines instead of interacting with other people.
So part of what was happening with Remem is that it's essentially a machine that is in some ways the person projected, right? It's a memory, but it's a person. So it's harder and harder to differentiate what's the machine and what's the person. And so say there are four people at a dinner table and each of them is texting or on their phones texting someone else. They're not necessarily connecting with each other at the table, but they're all connecting with a certain person that's maybe not there.
Yes. Well, yeah, okay. So, okay, as a somewhat sort of an example that maybe ties these two together, there's Google Glass, and Google Glass is just the first of what will perhaps be, you know, an entire, you know, new generation of wearable computers in which you will be, there will be this, all these products which, in which you will be ostensibly looking at one person's face, but you will actually be paying attention to something else.
Something else, yeah.
I think that is something that will happen more and more. You, at least now with a cell phone, you know when someone is on their cell phone. They're clearly looking at their cell phone. But, you know, we may get to the point where someone will be staring right at you, but they will be on their cell phone. And I think it's fair to say that is, you know, kind of dehumanizing. That what used to be a very personal interaction, a face-to-face conversation, you know, may no longer be that. The people that you are face-to-face with, you will no longer be certain whether you have their attention or not. Mm. You know, that is, that I think is the direction we're headed in with cell phones.
Well, I have a perfect follow-up from the audience, but it came from before you started talking about Google Glass, so I don't know how they manage that. But what do you want us students who will be responsible for the future to do?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I would like I'd like people working in the technology industry to think more about the long-term consequences of technology. Everyone loves iPhones. You know, people who own iPhones, they are very passionate about iPhones. But one of the things that I think the iPhone has introduced is this really rapid upgrade cycle. You now buy a pretty powerful and pretty expensive computer, and then you might replace it, you know, in a couple years, maybe not, you know, 18 months. Apple has created, you know, a thirst for the newest, greatest, you know, coolest product. Not to say that, you know, they were the first ones to do this, but I think that they have sort of perfected this. Is this really a good thing? Is this a good thing for people to be coveting the newest model so soon after buying after spending, you know, some serious sum of money on the last model? What lies behind that? What was the motivation for that? Was that just, you know, I mean, okay, yes, the new model phone, it can do a few more things, but I think it also has to do with their business model, you know, of generating a lot of profit by getting people to buy new stuff at very short intervals. Is that a good thing? Is that what you want to be doing? Is that the kind of world that you want to create? Is that the kind of behavior you want to promote? I guess I would like it if people working in technology spent some more time thinking about, what is the kind of world we want to live in, how can we appeal to people's lust for gadgets? Because I think, this is not an anti-technology rant, you know, but I guess it is more of a plea for maybe a more considered approach to technology.
So another question that sort of fits what you just said without having been written after what you said. I really like this effect now. My roommate and I saw connections between your story and the book series The Uglies by Scott Westerfield. Have you read the series? If you have, what are your thoughts on the technology displayed in the books? Are you familiar with The Uglies?
I read the first novel. I read the first novel actually in manuscript because I'm a friend of the author Scott Westerfeld. And in fact, actually, I'm named in the acknowledgments for the first book because
excellent question.
Because Scott a lot of some of the inspiration for that came from a story I wrote and a conversation that he and I had.
Fantastic.
Uglies. Uglies, you know, is addressing some questions about surgically changing people, possibly improving people, certainly improving their appearance, having I won't spoil it, but but possibly also having some effect on things other than their appearance. And I think that there are definitely there's definitely a lot of the same questions arise. Because there are questions about costs and benefits, whether things that are appealing to the individual are they good for society as a whole, whether companies by sort of taking advantage of people's desires, can you get them to adopt things that maybe are not in those customers' best interest in the long run? I think yes, they definitely engage with a lot of the same questions. These are all questions that I think science fiction is well suited to asking. These are the things that I think make science fiction interesting and relevant today, because in various forms, these are questions that we have to confront now.
And we'll have to end on that. We're out of time. Nirmal, do you have a last thought before we shut this down?
It's a pleasure to have you here to even raise these questions, because I think something that we often forget at Georgia Tech is in the rapid pace of our study and scholarship here is the attitude of what's next. And sometimes in that process of saying like, okay, what's next? What's my next appointment? What's my next test? What's my next meeting? Always trying to push something that having you here and asking these questions asks us to pause for a moment and consider what it is that we're trying to do and what kind of world we actually want to live in. So I think all of us really appreciate you offering that for us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios in beautiful Atlanta, Georgia, on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology.
And what does Georgia Tech and WREK think about the opinions expressed on Consilience with Pete and Charlie?
They definitely don't want a piece of these, unless, of course, they agree with us, which they probably don't.
They might. You never know.
I don't think they do.